This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Finding pregnancy support you can trust is worth celebrating. Getting it on sale is worth belting Beyonce in your car. That's right. Ritual's Black Friday sale is on. Support your body's new nutrient needs with their clinically backed prenatal multivitamin. Or give back to your gut with Natal Biotic, a probiotic supplement for trying, pregnancy, and postpartum to support digestive, vaginal, and baby's immune health. At Ritual, quality is top priority. All of their supplements are clean, third-party tested for heavy metals, and 100% made traceable. Because you deserve high-quality support at every stage of your pregnancy journey. Cut prices without cutting corners and get their best savings on their best supplements with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's jump right in, and let's start with the Thai-Cambodia ceasefire, which is breaking down.
The Donald Trump Thai-Cambodia ceasefire was in his Nobel four-year consideration packet. Yes, the situation here seems to be trending in the wrong direction from the perspective of trying to keep the peace, I guess. Trump, of course, attended last month's Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit to sign, mostly, I think, to participate in a signing ceremony to enshrine the peace deal, the ceasefire deal between Thailand and Cambodia, ending the brief border conflict that those two countries had earlier this year and expanding it to include a lot of details, a lot of, you know, things to sort of calm tensions at the border. The Thai government announced earlier this week that it was suspending that ceasefire, the one that it signed last month. In particular, implementation details like the withdrawal of heavy weaponry from the border, the operations to demine the border, which had been resumed between the Thai and Cambodian militaries, those things it put on hold. Thailand is also holding 18 Cambodian soldiers who were detained back in July when the conflict was at its height and have still not been released. They were supposed to be released under the ceasefire agreement. That's on hold as well. It announced all of these things after another landmine incident at the border, which is how a lot of this got started back in July in the first place. Left two Thai soldiers wounded. I think one of them lost a limb in the blast. So the Thai government continually accuses, every time one of these incidents happens, accuses the Cambodians of freshly mining the border. The Cambodians deny this. They say any mines that are located in the border region are left over from the let's say, high level of violence that Cambodia experienced for much of the 20th century, which involved a lot of explosives that have been left behind. Nevertheless, the Thai government clings to this accusation and says it can prove that the Cambodians are laying new mines. So that was the first step. On Monday, the Thai government announced that it was suspending its ceasefire. On Wednesday, 2 days later, there was a shooting incident along the border. in which at least one civilian in northwestern Cambodia was killed in a village along the border. There are conflicting reports, as you might expect, as to how this happened. The Cambodian government, Hun Manet, the Cambodian prime minister, accused Thai soldiers of engaging in provocative actions for several days in order to, what he said was, instigate confrontations along the border, and that led to the shooting. The Thai military claims, in contrast, that Cambodian soldiers fired across the border first, and they were returning fire. Either way, at least one civilian was killed, and we had a new there's a shooting conflict apparently going on now, or was at least. Neither country is ready to repudiate the ceasefire altogether, but the Cambodian government on Thursday did evacuate people from that village, the village that where this incident took place on Wednesday. Hundreds of people moved away from the border, which is not probably a tenable thing for the Cambodian government to maintain. Yeah, I would say things are quite tense at this point. Not looking like a resumption of the July conflict is imminent, but they certainly seem to be heading in that direction.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Israel-Palestine. Let's start with Gaza, and let's talk about the Trump plan, which is stalling.
Yeah, there really doesn't seem to be much momentum behind getting from what's called phase one of Trump's ceasefire framework to phase two. This is largely because the capstone of phase one is supposed to be the creation of an international security force that will go into Gaza, at least into the 42-ish percent of Gaza that the Israeli military has deigned to allow Palestinians to occupy, and take over security responsibility from Hamas. Essentially, there is some allowance for a new Palestinian police force that this security force would train up and support. But that's down the road. Like, the first step is getting this international security force in place. There's no clarity as to what the responsibilities of the security force are going to be. A lot of governments that have been sounded out or that have expressed some generalized interest in participating are pulling back. It seems like the UAE, for example, said earlier this week that it's not interested in participating at this time. The Jordanian government has signaled a somewhat pessimistic note, as has the government of Azerbaijan. These are three countries that were considered likely or plausible participants in the force. Mostly this is because of the lack of clarity as to what this force is supposed to do. Most of the countries that are interested or might be interested in participating want to participate in basically a monitoring force, as a force that would function the way UN peacekeepers typically function. They go into a place, they monitor a ceasefire, but they're not there to enforce it or engage in combat with violators or anything like that. That doesn't seem to be what Donald Trump had in mind when he hashed out his security force. The other complication here is that countries that do seem willing to go in and play an actual security role, and I'm thinking specifically of Turkey, which is the only one, to my knowledge, that is really gung-ho to get into Gaza and play a role here. Turkey is unacceptable to the Israeli government because Turkey, the Turkish government and the Israeli government are not getting along these days. The Turkish government has gone so far as to issue arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli officials. So they are not really on the same page, and Israel would like to veto Turkish participation in the security force. So there's really this is just completely up in the air at this point. What brought this to a fine point, I guess, was there was a report in Politico on Tuesday on what they called a cache of private documents that have been circulating within the U.S. government. They were presented as slides during what Politico called a two-day symposium last month on the creation of the U.S. military's Civil Military Coordination Center in Israel. This is a new headquarters that it's set up, headquarters unit that it's set up to monitor the Gaza ceasefire from outside Gaza. The administration is insistent that there will be no U.S. forces in Gaza at any point here, but it's set up this coordination center in Israel to keep an eye on things. We'll talk about them again in a moment. But basically, in the discussions about setting up this center, there's a set of slides that were presented at this symposium on how to get from phase one to phase two. And the slides, anybody who's seen a classic South Park will be familiar with this. The slide basically that I saw in the Politico piece has like the details of phase one laid out on one side, the details of phase two laid out on the other side. And in the middle is an arrow with a question mark in it. So there's no transition from phase one to phase two. It's just something's going to happen and then we'll be in phase two. Hurrah. So that's the level of thinking that's going on apparently within the administration. So if it looks confused and unplanted on the outside,
that's because it apparently, is.
It's because it is. Yeah, it's because that's the way it looks on the inside too. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's up in the air here. And in the meantime, you know, the Israelis are still killing people in the single digits most days. It doesn't get, usually doesn't get into the double digits, but they're still killing people fairly regularly in Gaza, mostly claiming that they have encroached on the so-called yellow line, which demarcates IDF-held territory. The other aspects of the ceasefire are more or less remaining in place in the sense that, you know, they're still... Hamas and the other militant factions are still handing over the bodies of Israelis who have been in Gaza, or the remains of Israelis have been in Gaza for either since the October 7th attacks or in some cases even before that. You know, there is no indication of a resumption of heavy conflict in the Israelis. We may have mentioned this last week, have started standing down reservists, or talking about at least standing down reservists, which would be an indication that they are not planning any imminent return to major confrontation. Nevertheless, like the longer this festers without some progress in getting to the later stages, and you can't get without the security force, you don't get to the stage where there's this board of peace that Trump is supposed to chair that has ultimate executive oversight over the territory. There's no Palestinian, as I said, there's talk of a Palestinian police force. There's also the technocratic, so-called technocratic Palestinian committee that's supposed to run Gaza day to day. You don't get to any of those things until this security force is hashed out. And that, you know, that is the fuel for transitioning to the next phase, which also includes, a bigger Israeli withdrawal from the territory, not entirely, but pulling back from the so-called yellow line at this point, and other details that are, you know, should advance the situation, but it's stuck on this basically one point.
You mentioned it earlier, but let's talk about these further humanitarian developments.
Yeah, so one of the developments, these are a couple of things that may be actually positive. The most clearly positive one is that the Israelis announced on Wednesday that they're reopening the Zakim checkpoint, which is located along Gaza's northern border, to humanitarian traffic. You may ask, why haven't they reopened this checkpoint already? And that's a good question. I don't have an answer. They really haven't reopened that many checkpoints to allow more aid into Gaza. And that's part of the reason why aid is still far below the levels that it's supposed to be at under the terms of the ceasefire. But they announced on Wednesday that they're reopening Zakim, which, in addition to just adding overall capacity for, you know, getting trucks to the border and getting them screened and getting the aid moved into the territory, also provides a direct line into northern Gaza, which has, of course, been the hardest hit, as people are, I'm sure, aware, the hardest hit part of the territory under the Israeli genocide. So opening that checkpoint means that, you can get aid directly into northern Gaza rather than sending it in through Kerem Shalom in the south and having to navigate, you know, destroyed roads and rubble and all of the insecurity that is currently the norm in the rest of Gaza to get from Kerem Shalom into northern Gaza. You can just go directly into northern Gaza from Zakim. So that is, it seems to be a positive development. The Israelis say it's a permanent reopening. What they mean is it's open until we decide to close it again, but hopefully that won't be for a while. The second development The Washington Post reported this over the weekend. That coordination center that I mentioned earlier, the Civil Military Coordination Center, has apparently assumed responsibility, at least according to this Post piece. The Israelis say, no, this isn't true. But the Post reports is it has assumed responsibility for overseeing humanitarian aid from Israel. This is potentially positive. I mean, if you believe, as there is copious evidence, the Israelis have been throttling aid this entire time and you know, preventing it from getting into the territory, having anybody else take over that responsibility is probably a good thing. That said, the coordination center's been around for a couple of weeks at this point, so they barely have had time to get off the ground. And reporting about that operation has suggested that it is still quite chaotic. The Post called it chaotic and indecisive. So it's probably not well set up to take on this responsibility. And yet, you know, the alternative is that the Israelis keep running it, and that seems manifestly worse. So we'll see how that goes.
We will keep our eye on it, and we will update you, our lovely listeners. Let's stay in the region. Oh, actually, let's not stay in the region. Let's bring the region to us, Derek, and let's talk about
Bring the region to us.
Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara's visit to the White House, where Trump had one of his best lines recently. He got a fragrance for al-Shara, and he said he had one for him and one for his wife. And then he asked, how many wives do you have? Which in the wake of the Epstein...
Beautiful.
Which in the wake of the Epstein release emails and just the fact that all these guys are cheating on their partners.
The perfume pervert, President of the United States.
That's
Donald
pretty good.
Trump.
So tell us about this visit.
Yeah, Shara visited the White House on Monday in a first for Syrian heads of state and for ex-Al-Qaeda faction leaders. So he's breaking new ground for on both of those fronts. There was a flurry of activity that went on around this. The meeting itself, I think, was fairly anticlimactic. There was no meaningful development in terms of the proposed Israeli-Syrian security pact that the Trump administration is trying to broker. Shara is already, I think, working with the Israelis to some extent, but feels reluctant to go into a formal pact with them, especially as long as the Israeli military is occupying more Syrian territory on top of the territory that it already occupies in the Golan. Has, you know, taken more territory since the fall of the Bashar al-Assad government late last year. So that didn't really go anywhere. Needless to say, the Abraham Accord, the idea of bringing Syria into the Abraham Accords and normalizing relations with Israel didn't go anywhere. The Treasury Department did remove Shara from its specially designated global terrorist list a few days before the meeting. So that was nice of them, I suppose. The Trump administration announced another six-month waiver. This is the second one, I believe, that it's given. Of the CSAR Act, which is the legislation that controls most of the sanctions that the U.S. government currently has levied on Syria. There are some exclusions here involving any transactions that include Russia or Iran. They're still sanctioned, but the rest of it seems to, you know, has been waived again. I think the administration would have preferred to have to be able to present Shara with a full rescinding of the CSAR Act, but Congress has to act on that, and Congress can't even keep the government open. So how you expect it to do anything else is beyond me. So they weren't ready with that, but they did give him this extension of the waiver. They also announced, and this was a little bit downplayed, I was kind of surprised about this, the Syrian government announced that Shara had agreed, or that the Damascus has agreed, to join the Anti-Islamic State Coalition, which is still a going concern. It played this very close to the chest. Made like the Syrian information minister got on X, the Everything site, and made a very perfunctory statement saying that Syria has joined the anti-IS coalition in a political capacity, stressing that this was not necessarily a military decision, or that Syria was not necessarily playing a military role in the coalition. There was no big, you know, event. There was no big signing thing that Trump could brag about, you know, that he had gotten Syria on board or anything like that. It was very, very low key. So that was another development apparently coming out of this meeting, but not a big one, at least, according to how they played it.
Let's talk about these new election results in Iraq, which is just, you know, doing so great. They should really thank us for invading them and destroying their entire country, Derek. I was thinking that the other day.
I'm still waiting. Yeah, Iraq had a parliamentary election on Tuesday. There was early voting a couple of days ahead of time. Prime Minister Mohammed Shia Sudani is trying to become the first Iraqi prime minister since Nouri al-Maliki, who had a really fantastic run in that job and left office in 2014 to win a second term. So no Iraqi prime minister since Maliki has served more than one term, if that. Sudani's hoping to stick around. He declared victory basically shortly after the voting ended on Wednesday. It ended Tuesday night. On Wednesday, he declared victory. This is a bit misleading. It does appear that Sudani's Reconstruction and Development Alliance has won the election in the sense that it emerged as the largest bloc in the next parliament, but it's nowhere near a majority. And Iraqi elections, I mean, the Iraqi parliament is always atomized like this, so the elections are always followed by a lengthy coalition negotiation process. And in this case, Sudani's natural allies, the folks who supported him when he became prime minister in 2022, the Shia, the kind of pan-Shia coordination framework, most of that bloc, other than the group that's still, you know, running under his banner in the election, most of that group has split with him because they believe he's too friendly with the United States. So they are unlikely, at least without a lot of wrangling, to support him for prime minister this time, which means he's got to scramble around and find other coalition partners, which is much easier said than done. So while he has declared victory and in a sense did win the election in the barest way, you know, winning, getting more votes than any other party, I think his path to maintaining himself as prime minister is still a pretty unlikely one at this point. Anything can change, and often does in Iraqi politics. There can be wild swings from one day to the next in these situations. So I wouldn't count him out, but I don't think he's necessarily the favorite at this point to be prime minister when everything's finally sorted out.
Thanks, Derek. All right, let's move on to Pakistan. Let's talk about these suicide attacks, which have risked a new confrontation between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yes, there have been two suicide attacks that the Pakistani government is pointing to this week. One on Monday that targeted a military school in northern Pakistan in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. The more serious of them happened in Islamabad on Tuesday. That left, I believe, at least 12 people was the count that I saw dead. It was outside a courthouse, like a court building in the city. The bomber tried to get into the court building but detonated outside, which probably minimized the casualties to some degree or lessened them to some degree. In both cases, the culprit appears to have been the Pakistani Taliban. The Pakistani Taliban did claim responsibility for the Islamabad blast. I don't know about the one in the north, but they're the obvious suspect given the location. And the Pakistani government now on Thursday has alleged that both of the bombers themselves were actually Afghan nationals, which is a level beyond what it usually accuses Afghanistan of when the Pakistani Taliban conducts attacks. Pakistani Taliban is harbors or kind of operates from the Afghan side of the border oftentimes. And the dispute that we saw erupt into a cross-border conflict last month between Pakistan and Afghanistan has to do with the Afghan government sort of allowing the Pakistani Taliban to operate from within Afghanistan, and doesn't the Pakistani accusation is that Afghanistan doesn't do anything to interdict these operations. The Afghan response is always, you know, the Pakistani Taliban is your problem, not ours. We shouldn't have to take care of your internal security for you. So, you know, they kind of go back and forth on that. And their latest round of ceasefire talks, which was taking place in Istanbul last week, broke down late in the week without a resolution. Because of that same dispute, because the Afghans, you know, the Pakistanis are demanding the Afghan government take action. The Afghan government says it's not our problem, and they just kind of go back and forth there. So things are tense anyway, sort of a baseline. And then these two attacks took place, and now the Pakistanis are accusing or are saying that both bombers were actually Afghan nationals, not even Pakistanis crossing the border, but actual Afghan nationals. So that takes it to a new level, I think. There is a strong possibility. I don't know how strong, but that we could see a resumption of that border conflict that we saw last month, kind of heating up again.
Let's talk about this new constitutional amendment that was also passed in Pakistan, which has given the military even more power than it already had, and it already had quite a significant amount of power.
Yeah, the 27th Amendment to the Pakistani Constitution passed Parliament this week. It is a sort of a grab bag of things, but the upshot is that it leaves Asim Munir, who used to be the head of the Pakistani army and was already de facto the most powerful person in Pakistan, whose prestige has shot skyward since the conflict, the Kashmir conflict with India earlier this year, and is, you know, just been kind of hailed as a national hero since then. It enshrines him as chief of defense forces. So he gets a promotion out of this from the head of the Pakistani army to the head of the entire Pakistani military, the position of joint chiefs of staff, chairman, which is more or less, did exist in the Pakistani system, more or less equivalent to the similar office in the U.S. military. That's been done away with. So Munir now controls everything. He controls the Navy, the Air Force. He's the one man in charge of the Pakistani military, which is the most powerful institution in the country. The amendment also gives him legal immunity for life. It gives him his current rank of field marshal. For life, field marshal, to which he was promoted after, again, the conflict with India earlier this year. It really enshrines him as the central figure in the Pakistani government or Pakistani political establishment. The other thing it does is it supplants the Pakistani Supreme Court, which has on occasion acted as a break on the otherwise unchecked power of the military governmental apparatus. It takes away its constitutional role and gives it to a new constitutional court whose judges, justices, I'm not sure which they're called, what they're calling them, will be directly appointed and beholden to the government. So it removes a lot of the independence or it establishes this much less independent entity to hear constitutional cases, and the Supreme Court will be reduced to, I think, appellate matters mostly. It enshrines the military and it streamlines the system to remove what had been a sometimes check on the military's power.
Now let's turn to a topic with most of the Western media has been ignoring for a long time, and that is Sudan. And let's talk about the RSF, which has been hiding the carnage that it committed or led to in Al-Fashir.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the RSF's conquest of Al-Fashir, the killing that ensued during that conflict or during that conquest. What's new this week is the Sudan Doctors Network, which is one of many kind of local communitarian NGOs functioning in Sudan, trying to help people deal with this war between the RSF and the Sudanese military, accused the Rapid Support Forces of basically trying to cover up the extent of the death toll in Al-Fashir after their conquest. And that's by conducting mass burnings of bodies, digging mass graves in the city or around the city to put bodies into, basically just to obfuscate the level of the size of the bloodbath that their fighters engaged in when they took that city. It's impossible to know ultimately how many casualties ensued, because there's just no information coming out of Al-Fashir at this point. We may learn at some point how violent it was, but right now everybody's just doing some estimates. The United Nations estimated that about around 82,000 people fled Al-Fashir when the RSF came in and seized it. Many of those evacuated to towns or villages around Al-Fashir, but many more were killed along the way or died trying to make the journey without any supplies, food, water, etc. So that's another kind of black hole in terms of the level of casualties that have ensued from this. But there were still about 260,000 people believed to be in the city when it fell. So you take 82,000 out of that, there's still tens of thousands of people at the mercy of the RSF, which has been credibly accused of genocide all over Darfur and has its roots in the genocidal Janjaweed militia going back to the Darfur genocide. So the potential for high, heavy casualties here, civilian casualties, is quite high. But yeah, it's been hard to gauge just how high it's gotten.
Let's turn to the endless war in Ukraine and let's talk about these Russian military advances.
Yeah, this has been a week for the Russians. They've advanced deeper into the two cities in eastern Ukraine that they were pressing, Kupiansk and Pokrovsk. Russian war bloggers, that's the term of art, I guess, that's used here, were posting video of Russian soldiers kind of swarming into Pokrovsk on motorcycles and other kind of scavenged vehicles. They've taken advantage of some inclement weather, fog in particular, in eastern Ukraine to kind of dodge Ukrainian drones, which means the Ukrainians have a hard time, Ukrainian artillery has a hard time spotting them. So they've taken advantage of the cover of that fog to I think, move more fighters into these cities. The bigger development potentially, less expected development, has come in Zaporizhia Oblast, which is in southeastern Ukraine. The Russians are also advancing there. Pokrovsk and Kupiansk have been under pressure for weeks now, and it's, you know, this is just a progression of that. But in Zaporizhia, this is somewhat new. The Ukrainian military withdrew from a number of villages in that province earlier this week after the Russians destroyed the local defensive works that they had erected. The defensive line seems to have stabilized, although the Ukrainian military still says there are at least three other villages in Zaporizhia that are being contested between them and the Russians. So that is a potential thing to keep an eye on. I mean, any time there's a weakness or a shift in the defensive line, it could always wind up leading to a rout of the Ukrainian forces and a bigger, you know, Russian exploitation. But we don't, that doesn't seem to be happening in Zaporizhia yet. It's just something to monitor, I think.
So Derek, for the next one, we're not going to do an update, but we're going to insert an interview that you did with Nathaniel Powell about Cameroon.
Yeah.
And the post-election unrest.
Yeah, Cameroon's
unrest.
Under some, you know, a considerable amount of unrest. Paul Biya, who's been president since 1982 and is 92 years old, just won officially, at least, his eighth term in office, even though his main opposition, the main opposition candidate, Issa Chiroma, claimed victory in the election. There's been a fair amount of unrest. You know, people are dissatisfied. In at least parts of the country are dissatisfied with Biya. So yeah, I talked to Nathaniel again. He was on the program a couple of weeks ago to talk about Madagascar. I talked to him again about the situation in Cameroon. So we'll go to that now.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. As seasons change and days grow darker sooner, it can be a tough time for many. That's why it's important to stay connected. It's time to reach out and check in with those you care about and to remind ourselves that we're not alone. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to check in on friends, reconnect with loved ones, and let them know that you're there. Just as it can take a little courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel difficult too, but it's worth it. And it almost always leaves people wondering, why didn't I do this sooner? With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/the nation. That's BetterHelp.com/the nation.
Finding pregnancy support you can trust is worth celebrating. Getting it on sale is worth belting Beyonce in your car. That's right. Ritual's Black Friday sale is on. Support your body's new nutrient needs with their clinically backed prenatal multivitamin, or give back to your gut with Natal Biotic, a probiotic supplement for trying, pregnancy, and postpartum to support digestive, vaginal, and baby's immune health. At Ritual, quality is top priority. All of their supplements are clean, third-party tested for heavy metals, and 100% made traceable. Because you deserve high-quality support at every stage of your pregnancy journey. Cut prices without cutting corners and get their best savings on their best supplements with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I'm joined now by Nathaniel Powell. He has been gracious enough to come back on the program. He is the West and Southern Africa analyst at Oxford Analytica. He's an honorary researcher at Lancaster University's Center for War and Diplomacy. Nathaniel, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with an easy question. Summarize Paul Biya's political career since 1979. You have
BC,
a minute and
right?
a half. So who is Biya, and how has he maintained himself in power? I mean, you know, he's been president since 1982. He's the oldest, I think, head of state in the world. He's been between his presidency and prime ministership. He's been in power since 1979. So who is this guy, and how has he managed to stay in power for so long?
Right. So Biya is certainly a wily politician, and that's part of it. So he came on as the prime minister of President Ahmadou Ahidjo, who was president of Cameroon since its independence in 1960. And Ahidjo gave up power in 1982. There's a lot of questions about why he did it. Some say he thought he was very sick and close to death and didn't want to be president when he died. Others suggest that this was some strange maneuver to expose his enemies. I mean, I think there's not a whole lot of, you know, good reasons why this happened, but he basically gave up power, handed it to Paul Biya, decided a bit afterwards he wanted it back. And Biya essentially said, no, you're not having it back.
No take-backs. Come on, yeah. man. Like, no take-backs.
Yeah, exactly. And this culminated in a major coup, a coup attempt in 1984 with a military faction that supported Ahidjo, tried to take power and failed. And Ahidjo spent the rest of his life exiled in France and died in France, I think in the 90s sometime. So that was the only time Biya faced a serious threat to his rule in a non-electoral sense. He opened up political competition to multi-parties, I think, in 1990. There was a highly contested election in 1992. A guy named John Frudi almost certainly won the election, almost certainly beat Biya. Cameroon had experienced serious economic difficulties in the 80s, structural adjustment. There was a lot of discontent about his rule. Frudi beat him, and Biya, in response, beat a lot of Frudi's supporters into the ground using, you know, his police and managed to retain power. And that's kind of been his modus operandi. You mix repression with co-option. So a lot of former opposition figures end up in his government. You know, you get a cushy government job and patronage, and then you tone down your criticisms, or you stop criticizing the government. And the guy who ran against Biya this time around was one of these people, Issa Chimo Bakary. And he had for a long time been neutralized by Biya by being integrated into his government. And was a long time minister until earlier this year.
So what caused that fallout, I guess? Having been brought in, why did he, you know, come back out again and run against Biya and at least claim to have won the election? You know, we can discuss that in a second. But what is his background?
Right. So he's a prominent northern politician. And so Cameroonian politics is, like it is in a number of countries in the region, is highly regionalized within the country, you know, like it is in the United States as well, to some extent. Biya has tried to maintain a balance of kind of ethnic and regional figures within his governments over time and among his political allies to try to ensure adequate, you know, vote totals in elections, but also to prevent, you know, kind of regionalism from taking off. This one failure was in the Anglophone regions. And since 2017, we've seen a civil war, essentially, that's ongoing at the moment. So Chiroma came from the north. Chiroma was very useful to Biya as a big vote, a gatherer of votes, of northern votes from the north. The north was important to Biya because this was the stronghold of Amadou Ahidjo, the former president who tried to overthrow Biya once Biya was in power. So it was very important to Biya to try to secure his stronghold there, to secure his support there. And Chiroma was, starting in the 1990s, one of these individuals that was critical to Biya's kind of foothold in the north. So when he left, announced that he was leaving the government in, I think it was June or July, this was a big kind of a flashing warning sign that maybe there was a problem in the ruling coalition, that this is potentially an issue. Still, at that point, we all thought that the main problem Biya was going to face was Maurice Kamto, who was the main opposition leader, who probably beat Biya in 2018. It was also similarly, you know, he's arrested and his movement was suppressed after the election. But then the government found a way to disqualify Maurice Kamto from the presidential election using kind of technical arguments and a very compliant court, an electoral commission. And so Kamto couldn't contest the election. So, but you had a number of others, about a dozen others that were contesting the election. And it's kind of, I don't think it was expected by many people that Chiroma would come out as the main opposition figure, because he had been so attached to Biya for so long. I think that a lot of people, especially outside the north, questioned his credibility. Biya has a long history of kind of sponsoring opposition candidates as a way of just splitting up the opposition vote and giving them, you know, give them cushy jobs afterwards as a reward. And I think there was some suspicion that he was one of these guys. It turns out that, you know, whether or not that was what happened at the beginning, that he ends up finding out that he is drawing massive crowds. There's been building up for a long time considerable discontent in northern Cameroon over Biya's rule. And I think he's tapped into that. He's tapped into that considerably over the past couple of months leading up to the election. And the crowd size he was drawing were absolutely tremendous. I think within a couple of weeks of the election, it started to become clear that he was going to be the main challenge to Biya. And there was about half the opposition ended up rallying to him. The other half didn't. But that seems that was enough to ensure that he was, you know, that nobody else came close to getting his vote totals. Yeah, so he's kind of a mystery in some ways. Because he was this. If you'd asked me, you know, 6 months ago, who's going to be Biya's main challenger, he would not have made the top 100 of them.
Interesting.
And it turns out that it's this guy. So, yeah.
So this, you hinted at something that leads me to my next question. I mean, Chiroma claimed victory shortly after the election, which is a gambit, right? I mean, you don't know, but you're trying to create a fact, you know, a set of facts on the ground that challenge what is eventually going to come out as Biya's victory. You know, regardless of how the voting actually went, I guess. But that also kind of leads me into this question. Like, as we're trying to evaluate that claim, what has been the typical kind of observation about Cameroonian elections in terms of how Biya manages the system to remain in power? Is there outright rigging in the vote count? Does the co-optation come before that, as you said, you know, kind of introducing controlled opposition to split the vote, or outright denying prominent opposition figures a chance to run, like the manipulation, you know, ahead of time? Like, what is his typical sort of pattern here? And is it plausible to think that Chiroma may have actually won the vote count and they just, you know, introduced a fictional number to give Biya the victory?
Yeah, so this is my opinion, and that's that I think Biya's regime was caught off guard by Chiroma's momentum. They expected the threat to come from Kamto, and they used lawfare very effectively to disarm that threat. And I think they felt that with him out of the game, there were a couple other relatively prominent opposition figures, a guy named Cabral Libi, who gained a lot of kind of youth support in 2018, but is not particularly radical, and I think they could buy him off essentially, and a number of others weren't seen as a major threat, but Chiroma he came out of the blue in a way, in a lot of ways, so they weren't prepared for it. I think that's what led to like the messiness of this election, in the sense that the rigging was kind of obvious. If you look at the If you look at the figures that were the official figures that were presented by the Constitutional Commission, or sorry, Constitutional Council, that were released on October 27th, I believe. If you go through them, you see lots of weird stuff. You see like very implausible turnout figures for parts of the country that you wouldn't expect this level of turnout, like 80%, 90%. You see some districts where Bia wins like 97% of the vote. Some areas where you have more electors than registered voters. I mean, this stuff, you know, this is not the sort of thing that you know, it's clear that these figures are doctored. That being said, Chiroma released his own set of figures. And you can do that because you can collect the vote tallies at each polling station independently, and you could aggregate them. And he had observers in different polling stations. He didn't do it for the whole country, but did for parts of the country. And the figures that he published suggests that, you know, he's almost certainly the winner. I mean, overwhelming. I mean, one was like 70% of the vote or something like that. But there are problems with his figures too. It's similar to Bia's figures in the sense that the same kind of irregularities, although not as systematic. That being said, I think the perception is fairly widespread that Chiroma won. I think that the official figures are certainly rigged. You know, this will not be the first time that an opponent likely won a presidential election in Cameroon, and yet the government finds a way to weather that storm. That being said, elections are dangerous moments for Bia, and as they are for many authoritarian leaders across the region. They, you know, it's a ritual they have to engage on. They have to go through for all sorts of legitimation purposes. But these are the moments of the highest danger, you know, outside of like a coup d'état, and in some cases it provokes a coup d'état, like it did in Gabon 2 years ago. So this is the moment where the opposition can count, and they can try to create a crisis. But Bia has been very effective at weathering these storms, and you know, now he's 92 years old, and he'll be 93 in February, and his term is a 7-year term, so he'll be almost 100 by the time that this term ends.
You're only as old as you feel. He's still a young, vibrant.
He's a young buck. I mean, he spends most of his time in Switzerland.
Does he even appear in public? I mean, this is sort of getting us off the track here, but like, I got the sense during the campaign that he's like, doesn't even really make public appearances at this point, or very rarely. And it's only very carefully managed, right?
Oh, it's all highly choreographed. He made one public appearance during the campaign, a speech, and it didn't look too bad, to be honest. To see him, I didn't watch the whole speech, but I watched part of the speech. I'm like, I mean, for an 92-year-old, it's not too bad. I mean, it wasn't a long speech, but but he has had serious health problems in the past. There's jokes about, you know, he's been dead for years. What we see is an animatronic kind of, you know, carcass that acts like a president. He spends a lot of his time at the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva and hospitals in Geneva. I don't know. I mean, it's possible he lives through the term. The biggest fear now, I think, is not so much this crisis can be prolonged. Chiroma's now in exile, and he's just fled to Nigeria. He's trying to keep
Let's talk about the situation now, just in general. What's the latest figures in terms of the number of people who have been like arrested, killed by security forces? You know, how big has the lockdown gotten? I know there was one point there was supposed to be a general strike that I think caught on in the north at least, but maybe not everywhere. Like, where does the situation stand at this point?
Right. So the initial protests were pretty bloodily repressed, and we're talking the official government figures were 16 dead and 800 arrested for the early stages of this protest. The opposition claims that the death toll could be higher than 50, with maybe over 1,000 arrests. The UN office in Cameroon says that probably they estimate that unofficially, according to reports that were citing UN officials, something like they counted 48 dead. So we're talking about, you know, fairly rough repression. Chiroma called for what they call a ghost town. This is a pretty common form of protest in the region where people just don't leave their homes for a period of days. It's like kind of a self-lockdown. The streets are emptied. It's essentially a general strike. And as you said, it was widely followed in the north. It was widely followed in Douala, which is the kind of economic capital of the country. It's in the southern coast of Cameroon. and parts of the Anglophone regions, and some other parts of the country. But it was not highly, it's not heavily followed in Yaoundé, which is the capital, and the center region also wasn't particularly well followed. I would say the response to this has been uneven, which raises questions, of course, about his ability to keep this up. You know, Biya is almost certainly betting on the momentum, kind of stalling, and this, you know, kind of petering out. I think another fear is that since Chiroma is in Nigeria now, he's fled to Nigeria, that Nigerian authorities will be reticent about allowing him to play a major role in mobilizing the Cameroon opposition, because that can undermine bilateral ties, which, you know, are kind of important, especially for like security cooperation and things like that. So they might try to, make him quiet instead of in exchange for letting him be there. Alternatively, right, he returns to Cameroon, you know, they might try to arrest him, and that could also provoke another wave of protests. But I think the Cameroon authorities are actually kind of happy that he's in Nigeria now, because they can keep him there. Things quiet down. Yeah. Eventually they could try to extradite and arrest him when people don't care as much. That's a possibility as well.
So to take us out of this, what are you looking at in terms of like implications here? There are a couple of ways to go at this. I mean, there's certainly the security challenges. You mentioned both of the big ones, the Anglophone separatist war, essentially, and security challenges involving jihadists, mostly in the Lake Chad region, I guess, Boko Haram and Islamic State. But there's also the international aspect of this. I know, like, Biya, in terms of his relationship with the West, which means in this part of the world, first and foremost, relationship with France. Like, he's France's last friend, it seems like, in the Sahel these days. So I don't imagine there's been much outcry from the champions of freedom and democracy and all of that sort of thing, because he's pretty well paid up with all those folks. But what can we say in terms of some of these bigger picture things as this crisis continues, or as it's been manifest?
Yeah, so it's a good question. The French response has actually been quite muted. They haven't congratulated him on his victory, which is usually a pretty big sign that they're not quite happy with how things have gone. Biya has also had in Cameroon itself, the perceptions are widespread that France plays a really influential role in the country, and that's true up to a point. But Biya has long had kind of a roller coaster in his relationship with the French. He prefers to spend his time in Switzerland, not France, when he goes to Europe, and he spends a lot of time there. He said at times in the 80s, 90s, he actually thought the French were trying to overthrow him, which probably wasn't true. But so there's a level of suspicion there that's kind of persisted. The U.S. embassy congratulated him for his inauguration, but not for his victory, which Cameroonians make a big distinction. They're like, well, the U.S. kind of did the minimum. There are no foreign heads of state, even regional heads of state went to his inauguration, which I think is the first.
You have to understand, he's an aspirational figure for U.S. politicians at 92, winning re-election. We're hoping to get there someday.
Well, we probably will. I mean, we had our own. We've had kind of two Paul Biyas in a row. Three if you count to one and twice. I don't know. I think that the regional response has been muted. The international response has been pretty, pretty limited. The EU has not, they've condemned the violence, called for, justice being given to the protesters. So I think that, but at the same time, you're not seeing like massive condemnations either. You're not seeing,
right.
Nobody wants to like really endorse this, but at the same time, nobody wants to turn this into a big deal either. So I think that this isn't going to be a big problem for Biya. If things peter out, 6 months from now, everybody forgets about it and things are back to normal, at least on the surface. The biggest threat right now is what happens after Biya dies, because you have there's a real coup threat, I think. There are a number of very powerful politicians within the ruling party that want to be president, that want to succeed him. He's not designated any kind of successor. He's very smart. You don't do that. And, this could be a recipe for serious unrest or instability or even conflict in the coming years, because this guy probably won't finish out his term. But then again, I'm not the first that's not the first time anybody said this about him, so.
Yeah, they probably said that last time, right? But yes, so let's leave it there. Nathaniel, thank you again so much for coming on the program. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks.
Well, everyone, we hope you enjoyed that interview. We're going to be doing more of those as time goes on, give people a little bit of a deeper dive. And for those of you who haven't subscribed to the podcast, that's the type of stuff, as you know, we do, what would be en masse every week and our Sunday bonuses. So if you haven't subscribed, please consider doing so. All right, Derek, let's return to the news. Let's talk about the United States basically, I guess, trying to gin up some sort of war or trying to just do gunboat diplomacy with Venezuela. And let's talk about the USS Gerald R. Ford arriving in the Caribbean, as well as international criticism of the United States' boat attacks on Venezuelan boaters. Yeah.
Speedboats. We're against speedboats now. Yes, I mean the Gerald Ford was redeployed a couple of weeks ago by the U.S. military to the Caribbean. It's finally arrived. It is the largest, most advanced aircraft carrier in the U.S. Navy. It's the first ship of the Gerald R. Ford class, which is supposed to be much more advanced. It's like every other advanced weapons platform that the U.S. military is churning out. These days, it has an untold number of problems with it. And nevertheless, it is a major show of force, at least, directed at the Venezuelan government. This is the point, I would say, if Donald Trump is finally going to give way to the people in his administration who want to at least conduct airstrikes on Venezuela, if not, you know, go further than that to try and oust Nicolas Maduro. This is the point where they would do that. I mean, there's not much more they can do to amass forces in the Caribbean. So this seems like an important milestone. Trump has expressed, and this has been reported in a few places over the past couple of weeks, he's expressed some hesitation about going forward with even airstrikes on Venezuela on land targets, let alone a regime change operation. So who knows if this will actually amount to anything, or if it will just be a demonstration of force to try and pressure Maduro that way. As I say, I don't have any insight on that. It's just clear that this is it. Like, this is as packed as they're going to be able to make the Caribbean with U.S. military hardware. So if they're going to do it, they're going to do it now, or, you know, while the Ford is still there. As far as the war on drug boats or alleged drug boats goes, yeah, there's been some international criticism of this this week, particularly around this week's meeting of G7 foreign ministers in Canada. Little Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, attended that meeting. There were statements issued by the foreign ministers of Canada and France. Kaya Kallas, who is the European Union Foreign Policy Coordinator and always attends these G7 meetings for some reason, all of them issued statements expressing some criticism of these strikes on alleged drug trafficking boats, which the U.S. the U.S. Trump administration basically has admitted, like, they don't know who's on the boats. They don't really know very much about where they're going, but they keep bombing them anyway. So, yeah, that's where things stand. The Venezuela thing, obviously, we're keeping an eye on it. And I think, you know, we've reached a point where that could become a much bigger deal very quickly if Trump decides to go forward.
So, Derek, the other big news of the week was, of course, the Epstein email releases. We're not going to talk about it here in the news, but we hope to have a special up soon. Obviously, things can change where we go a little bit deeper into Epstein, national security, and all those good things. So for everyone listening, thank you, of course. If you haven't yet, check out our Discord. I noticed that people haven't been reviewing and rating us on iTunes as much because I've stopped begging them to do so. So if you could take a moment, rate and review us on Apple iTunes, that would be really great. And also, if you haven't subscribed to the show, please consider doing so. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of, you know, responsibility, Derek. We have responsibility to the people. So please consider subscribing. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
You won't find a better deal on science-backed pregnancy supplements than at Ritual's Black Friday sale. Get what you really deserve, like a prenatal you can trust. Made with bioavailable key nutrients, it even earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. Save 40% on your first month at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.